Sometimes, life just smacks you in the face. Cuddles Houlihan got hit in the face with a vodka bottle. Some crumb bum put into the pneumatic tube that's supposed to move copy from desk to desk at Bandbox Magazine. But the smack that caused his editor Joe Harris to scream was a picture of Leopold and Loeb in their cell at Joliet State Prison, reading a copy of Bandbox and smiling. Just the kind of photo that rival Cutaway magazine could make a lot of time with in ads on buses and subways. This Murdoch-Maxwell-Yankees versus Red Sox rivalry is at the core of Thomas Mallon's new novel, Bandbox, which ranges over the New York magazine world of the 1920s with a cast of mobsters, scriveners, molls, and hayseeds on the lam. Mr. Mallon has written a number of previously praised novels, including Dewey Defeats Truman and Mrs. Payne's Garage, joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time since we've been able to use the word crumb bum on the air. Thanks for bringing it back to the language.
Yeah, it's very... 20s lingo was one of the things I had to soak myself in for this book, and it's interesting to deal with 20s language because I think one of the things you find is that slang is not so much a class-based phenomenon. You find upper crust people using the same slang as shop girls and newsboys, and it's a very hard-edged, clever, ephemeral slang, but everybody uses it because nobody in the 20s wants to appear to be dim, to be somebody you could put something over on. There's such a premium on not being a sucker.
Let me ask you to read a section now, if we can, if you could set it up for us.
Sure. One of the things that Bandbox is trying to do to stay ahead of Cutaway is to put the first female on the cover of the magazine. This was an experience I remember from GQ as well, and figuring that that will get a lot of publicity. And the editor-in-chief, Joe Harris, has selected a Hollywood siren named Rosemary LaRoche to put on the cover of Bandbox. And she is as tough as any gangster's moll who's ever been around. They're lunching at the plaza. "Yes, sir," said Harris. "He may be late, but there he is." He directed Rosemary LaRoche's attention to George M. Cohan, now sitting down at his regular corner table in the Oak Room. "Yeah," said the film star, peeking through the smilax-wrapped trellis that shielded her from too much public view. "Give my regards to Broadway. The hell with Broadway," she declared, before putting a last bite of strip steak into her mouth. Disappointed at the failure of what he had hoped would seem an authentic New York treat to this sun-bronzed captive of the film colony, Harris tried soothing her. "Of course," he said, recalling a fragment of autobiography she'd imparted during the soup course. "You're remembering those short-sighted rejections when you were trying to get started here." He sympathetically imagined the scene. A beautiful girl being mistreated by those Broadway wolves.
"Wolves?" cried Miss LaRoche, tossing her napkin onto the remains of the steak. "In the whole 6 months I was up here, I never met one who wasn't a Nelly. I practically shoved my melons into their kisses, but you'd have thought they was live grenades the way those guys would flinch. Here," she said, extracting for a third time the small silver flask she kept in her garter. "You're still not completely thawed."
That's hooch, as we might say.
Hooch,
he's pouring.
Yes.
Yeah.
With no T. I've learned to spell hooch, H-O-O-C-H. I learned that during the editing process.
I don't think I have to ask what melons mean, but Nellie's, I'm a little. How was that?
Nellie is a very politically incorrect slang for gay men.
And geez.
The other thing about the 20s is it was the most flamboyantly politically incorrect decade I think the country has ever lived through. Mm-hmm. Nobody took any care with anybody's tender sensibilities, it seemed. It was a kind of, you know, brutal age. And I mean, this is a very kind of innocent book, but part of writing about that era is, to a certain extent, you have to surrender to it.
Is that part of what attracted you to writing about the period?
It may have been the fact that it was such a ruleless period, when there were so few constraints on people. I mean, everybody's id seemed to be running wild. I also wanted to write about it because I used to hear a little bit about it from my father, who left school when he was 14 in New York and went to work in, this was 1928, same year as the book, and had some of his first jobs in publishing. He worked as an office boy and messenger, and he used to tell me stories about it, stories I wish I'd paid closer attention to when I was growing up.
Now, you're talking about a time when magazines were, let me be careful about this, because you're the former literary editor of GQ, right? We're talking about a time when magazines were mass media, in a way that they are perhaps not today.
Well, radio was the great phenomenon of the decade, mm-hmm. and it was what drove the stock market bubble to some extent, the same way the internet and dot-coms drove the 90s bubble. But radio and even the movies at that point are still not what brings Gotham and the metropolis to the heartland for the average person in the 20s. It's still, as much as anything, subscription magazines. And so there's a character in this book, the sort of obligatory Rube, as you say, who comes to the city from Indiana. And his whole notion of what life in New York must be like is based on this magazine. And he is soon going to find out that this very polished, glossy, inevitable-looking product that he relishes each month when it arrives in his mailbox in Indiana is in fact produced by these harebrained, vice-ridden, calamity-prone, eccentric staffers.
Yeah, let's get something out of the way. You used to write for GQ Mag, or literary editor of GQ Magazine. So how much of this is thinly disguised portraiture of people you worked with at GQ just transposed to the 1920s?
Well,
and how much is an honest work of fiction?
The hero of the book is Joe Harris. And I plead guilty to his being based very closely on my old boss, Art Cooper, who, alas, died last June.
And just a couple of months after he retired.
Yes. And Art was a great outsized character, somebody who I think cried out for novelist. And he didn't read the book, but he knew it was coming. In fact, one day I was in his office, and the vodka bottle was out on the desk, which was very much his way at 5 o'clock. And he asked me what I was working on, and I mentioned this book. And in his very quick-witted way, he knew exactly what was going on here. And he looked at me, and he gave me this kind of glare. And in his deep, deep voice said to me, he said, "You do realize the only way I'll be angry is if people can't recognize me." And so I took that as my permission.
How do you immerse yourself in a period like the 1920s? I mean, it's got to be more complicated than just watching a lot of old Untouchables.
Right. I mean, this book was a little different for me because most of my historical novels have been tied to some big public event, whether it was Lincoln's assassination or the 1948 election or a space flight. So there was always some big event that was researchable. There really isn't such an event in this book, so it was more of a kind of general soak. Mm-hmm. And obviously I read a lot of magazines from the time, listened to a lot of 20s music, watched a lot of movies, read a lot of novels from the period, and tried to follow what I still think of as my basic rule for writing historical fiction, which is to try and read less about the period that you're writing about and read more from the period. Because if you read the language that novelists and journalists were actually using, you're more likely to be able to replicate it and get echoes of it in the dialogue of your characters and in your own narration.
Let's end this, if we can, with a reading from Bandbox, if you could.
Okay. This is Joe Harris, the editor-in-chief, receiving an essay that he has high hopes for, an essay about the great bull market. Always excited to get to the office, Harris had been looking forward to today as extra special. Following his arrival at 7:30, almost 3 hours ago, he'd waited for the Reynolds messenger to deliver this draft of the essay he'd commissioned for a small fortune from Henry Roebling, the 30-year-old big-game hunting literary sensation. A writer so virile and hairy-chested, he looked, when his shirt was open, like something he might have just shot. In life, Roebling always had an aviatrix or girl reporter ready to kill herself over him. On the page, he boiled his sporting and amorous adventures down to a prose so spare, it sometimes seemed he was being paid by the word for what he left out.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thomas Mallon, his new novel is Bandbox. And you'll find an excerpt from Bandbox and more information about Thomas Mallon's previous novels at npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. All you crumb bums, I'm Scott Simon.